the translation here, we'll skip the word for word because I want to move on to another text and verse. By following the paths of speculative philosophical knowledge, fruitive activity, or mystic yoga to control the senses, one cannot satisfy Krishna, the Supreme Lord. Unalloyed devotional service for Krishna is the only cause for the Lord's satisfaction. I'm going to say a little bit about this and then move to the next verse. This one has no purport, but the next verse does. I choose this verse among all verses in what I've written in the concluding chapter of Goswami's book, because I claim that prema bhakti rasa, now I'm doing the Sanskrit, okay, so prema bhakti rasa is the axial core of our Vaishnava theology. It is the very thing for which we are all after. It is the reason we chant the Maha Mantra. It is the reason we associate with devotees. It is the reason we read the Bhagavata. It is the reason we choose to live in a holy place. It's our raison d'être, okay? Bring in a little French there. Too bad, was it, Dhananjaya? Okay, good, thank you. So the idea here is that with the words prema bhakti rasa, each of these words, as I mentioned yesterday, so it's a little repetitive, each of these words, prema and bhakti and rasa, each of these are found over 1,000 times throughout the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Together as couplets, prema bhakti, bhakti rasa, or prema rasa, they're found hundreds of times. And the only time each of these words are found together as three is once in this very verse. So that is why I bring it out. And I claim in some sense that it is a kind of paribhasha sutra. That is to say, a singular instance of a powerful idea that is embedded in the way it affects everything else. It conducts, in some sense, our whole modality of thought in understanding our Krishna conscious practice. So I'll read to you what I wrote here in some sense to give a kind of purport to it, and then we'll move on. Let's see if I can find it. It's funny how when you write things, you don't know where anything is, and sometimes you even forget what you wrote. Okay, so, no, this is not it. Okay, it's okay, here we go. The core experience for which practitioners strive in this theology of love, what is envisioned and what is at the very heart of ISKCON's Prasthana Trayi sacred texts, I'm here referring to Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavat Purana, and Chaitanya Charitamrita, is most potently expressed by the singular appearance of a three-word phrase found in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, prema, bhakti, rasa. In the briefest fashion, the meaning of these three words taken together in this phrase may be understood as the following. With purest love, prema, it is the offering of the heart, bhakti, within the most intimate dance of love between two hearts within the divine, rasa. So the idea here is Krishnadas Kaviraj is saying that the dharmas of yoga and karma and jnana are simply not what bhakti is. It is interesting to observe that yoga is a word that appears throughout the Bhagavata. It's certainly a word that appears about 157 times throughout the Gita in its verbal and nominal forms. And suddenly, when we get to the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we don't like yoga very much. Isn't that interesting? In fact, there are some verses in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that have some nasty things to say about yoga. And what we need to understand about that and why there's a difference is because we need to understand it against the history of the development of yoga. You see, in the ancient period of yoga, which occurs prior to 800 BCE, we have a very serious meditative practice. And then in the pre-classical forms of yoga, when we have the texts of the Gita and the Yoga Sutra being highlighted and appreciated in light of yoga, we have again the deepened sense of what yoga is. And the Yoga Sutra was actually considered to be written around the 200 BCE era. And this is where all the teachings of yoga and sort of the fruits of meditational yoga really came together. It's in the post-classical period. So then there's the classical period of yoga. And that's where we have the commentaries to the Yoga Sutra and so on. But then we have the Hatha Yoga Pradipika arising there. And this is the manual where suddenly asanas start becoming kind of important. The ability to twist your body into some kind of contortion, and this somehow is a great accomplishment. And by the time the medieval period comes, when the Chaitanya Charitamrita is written in the post-classical era, in a way, yoga sort of took over in a more superficial fashion, and people were being satisfied with rather superficial achievements in yoga. A little bit like the way yoga came to America in the 60s, it started off being very meditational. And now it's just all asana. All asana. And despite the fact that in the Yoga Sutra, the word asana only appears 2 times in its 196 sutra texts. Jai Shri Sharadaka. So if we understand how yoga became more and more removed from its essential purpose and more distracted by paranormal states and achievements of various siddhis and so on, the very things that Patanjali in the Yoga Sutra warns against, that's why the Vaishnavas don't like yoga by the time of the medieval period. Okay? So yoga during the Bhagavata and the Bhagavad Gita is perfect. It's wonderful. Yoga was something to be attained, but not yoga of the medieval period. Who cares about how long you can, hold your arm up? I mean, I've seen yogis who are very proud of holding their arm up like this for 10 years. I mean, to me, it would be very annoying to know someone like that. I mean, it'd be really annoying. Like, do you need some help? Right? Standing on one leg. I mean, some of the things they do are really kind of, at the very least, weird, and some things disgusting. So this is not really the goal of yoga. The goal of yoga is to meditate deeply on the Supreme. That's the goal of yoga. And that is what is emphasized in the Bhagavad and in the Bhagavad Gita. Now, of course, yoga and bhakti, the bhakti really became announced in the Bhagavad Gita. Prior to the Bhagavad Gita, really, we don't have a lot of philosophical and theological illumination on bhakti per se. The word bhakti really rarely appears anywhere in the sense that we know it to have now, this sense of devotional service, the sense of offering the heart fully to the divine as a beloved. So what I think is important to understand here, and the job of someone like Tamal Krishna Goswami and myself, persons who are involved in the intellectual and theological explication of Vaishnava thought, is to bring some of these understandings to the forefront. That's what our job is. Just as it is the job is a bad word. Service, seva, okay? It is the seva of the pujari to honor the deity and to offer various wonderful articles to the deity. Everyone has a seva. And so Tamal Krishna embarked on this kind of seva, of delving deeply into not only the philosophy and theology that Prabhupada brought, but to understand it in light of world thought, to bring it into conversation with world thought, not to remain isolated from world thought, but to bring it into conversation, into dialogue with world thought. And I think this has been one of the hardest things for the movement. We're very comfortable in our own little box here. It's so nice. No one disrupts us. We have our routines, you know. We know exactly what to do at different times of the day, especially in the morning hours, and it's just, it's very peaceful, very calm. No one touches us. But it's a very different world out there. It's a very different world. I remember I was talking about Goswami's book up in the Brooklyn Temple. That's in the United States. Brooklyn. I don't know how well you know your geography here, so I thought I would let you know. It's in the eastern part of the United States. So at the end, there was a lady in the back who asked a question. She said, I really love Krishna consciousness and practicing it, but my parents are Christians, and they don't understand what I'm doing when I practice my japa or my various devotions. She said, what can I say to my parents? Now, I can read minds. I don't know if you're aware of that. But I could read the minds of every devotee and the way they would respond to that. And one of the ways that I heard their minds responding was, tell your parents that God the Father, the person they're worshiping as God the Father, is Krishna. I can hear them saying that in their minds. In fact, I can hear mainly some of you down here. Yeah. And I really want you to stop it right now. And in fact, the proof that I was right is the temple president was surprised to hear, Ram Bhadra has been there forever in Brooklyn. Anyway, he was surprised to hear my answer. And in fact, confessed that that's what I thought you were going to say, something like that, that tell them that we're worshiping the same God and you know, God the Father is our Krishna. My response to the young lady was, why don't you ask your parents what it is that they love so much about their God? Ask them. Find it. I mean, and be sincere about it. What do they love so much about their God? And then they might be more receptive to asking you what you love about your God. Enter into dialogue. Don't stay isolated. To tell another person what they believe in, what their vision is not a good idea. Feelings for the divine are absolute. You cannot tell someone how they feel. Even mundane feelings are absolute, relative to you. The way you feel, the way a person feels, is not something you can alter by declaring it not to be valid. But you might be able to change or elevate the way someone feels by entering into dialogue. Besides, it never really sat well with me to consider Krishna as God the Father. He doesn't seem very fatherly to me. He seems more playful and delightful and beautiful. And when I compare Krishna, with Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel painting of God the Father, who is a kind of, well, he kind of looks like me. He's kind of gray, but he's a lot more buff and macho. It's sort of, if imagine if I had worked out. Bhagavat Ashray, if you would keep your laughter a little bit. I'm sorry I gave you that visual, but the idea is that really it's not about trying to read our Krishna consciousness into other traditions. It's about connecting with other people's hearts. And this is the way we will affect others in such powerful ways with what it is that we have to offer. It's not a question of, you know, in some sort of false authoritative position saying that you know better what they believe in than what they know. There's some hubris involved in that. So it is our job as doctors, and I don't mean PhDs here, but doctors of the heart. We're here to heal others' hearts. We're here to be shelters for other people's hearts. You know that that strange thing we chant, right? When sometimes we see each other and we go, Vancha Kalpa, Kalpa Taru, Kalpa Taru. A Vaishnava is supposed to be a Kalpa Taru, a desire tree. That means, theoretically, when you see a Vaishnava, you could ask him or her for anything, and somehow they will satisfy you. A Kalpa Taru. Okay? And then it gets worse. Kripa Sindhu. I'm happy if I can eke out a puddle of kripa for anybody. But it means, Sindhu means an ocean of mercy, of grace, of compassion. So these are the things that we must display, not, you know, a doctrinal insistence on what others believe or say and so on. Not a position from which we are somehow able to judge others. We're here to appreciate the way people's hearts are placed and then to come into dialogue with that. Actually, there's a beautiful passage by Saint Augustine in his book called The Confessions. And he starts out by saying, what do I love when I love my God? And he goes on to say what it is. And in that mood, we should also be saying, what is it that we love when we love our God? Mahaprabhu Gauranga's mood also was very much in that way. He would go and meet people of all kinds of faiths, and he would engage in dialogue with them. And of course, he would offer his own thinking. We can't all do what he did. I mean, when he came across Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he sat there for, I think it was 7 days, right? 7 days, 7 nights, and just listened. I mean, talk about real hearing and patience and compassion. 7 days and 7 nights, I don't think I could do it. I could do 7 hours. The university sort of trained me to sit there for 7 hours. So it's possible for me to sit for 7 hours, but 7 days and 7 nights, I don't recommend that for anybody. But the point is, you know, that Shravanam process is to hear not only the Maha Mantra, but to hear Krishna speaking through others, and to be able to respond to Krishna through others' hearts. To worship at the altar of the hearts of others. Because remember, Krishna, you know, we understand that Krishna is in everyone's heart, so why not worship at that altar as well as this altar? I think the whole point of this altar is to recognize that there are innumerable, unlimited altars at which we can worship. Now, this is not to say that you go for a walk and you stop everyone and say, excuse me, I would like to worship at the altar of your heart right now. Would you stand still? And I would like to perform puja right now. And you have your little puja kit. It's not quite like that, but it all happens in here. Take your puja kit in here and offer that in so many ways and with so many words. So I'd like to move to the next verse after 1775. 1776. That happens to be the year that the Americans won the Revolutionary War. I'm sorry, I couldn't help but bring that up. I didn't pick this verse because it was 1776. It just happens to be that. It's not really my fault, but I just wanted to bring that out. The next verse happens to be a verse from the Bhagavatam. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, said, "My dear Uddhava," the 11th canto, "neither through Ashtanga Yoga," the mystic yoga system to control the senses, "nor through impersonal monism, or an analytical study of the absolute truth, nor through study of the Vedas, nor through austerities, charity, or acceptance of sannyasa, can one satisfy me as much as by developing unalloyed devotional service unto me." Purport. Karmis, jnanis, yogis. So here he's referring to the previous verse, right here. And tapasvis. And students of Vedic literature who do not have Krishna consciousness simply beat around the bush and do not get any final profit because they have no clear knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Nor do they have faith in approaching him by discharging devotional service, although everywhere such service is repeatedly emphasized, as it is in this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11:14:20. The Bhagavad Gita, 1855, also declares, "One can understand the Supreme Personality as he is only by devotional service or bhakti." If one wants to understand the Supreme Personality factually, he must take to the path of devotional service and not waste time in profitless philosophical speculation, fruitive activity, mystic yoga practice, or severe austerity and penance. I think that's my mother. Tell her I'll call her back later. Elsewhere in the Bhagavad Gita, 12:5, the Lord confirms, "For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome." People who are attached to the impersonal feature of the Lord are obliged to take great trouble, yet nevertheless, they cannot understand the absolute truth. As explained in Srimad Bhagavatam, Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavan Iti Shabdyate, unless one understands the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the original source of both Brahman and Paramatma, one is still in darkness about the absolute truth. Now you know, here we have to be very mindful here of the way Prabhupada speaks and the way we should speak. We should not be imitative of Prabhupada. But Prabhupada always said, speak according to your realization. Now, a realization shouldn't be, I should just imitate my spiritual master. That's not a realization. That's a false understanding, okay? We make a distinction between anukara, right, and anusara. Anukara comes from kri, you know, to follow by making or performing as if you were Srila Prabhupada. Whereas anusara means following by something that flows from Prabhupada to us and the way we digest it and understand it sincerely and then offer it to others. So the difference, anukara, anusara. So Prabhupada can be pretty strong. His words could be strong. And you have to remember that Prabhupada was coming out of a milieu in India where, I mean, that had to be, that kind of strength had to be there. And for Prabhupada, that was fine. And anyone who saw Prabhupada witnessed Prabhupada speaking to others, he could get away with almost anything. Isn't it right, Dhananjay? I mean, right? And that's Rupa Velasco there, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't that right, Rupa Velasco? I mean, he could say he had a certain aura about him. But we're not to imitate. Preach or teach according to our own realization of what's truly said here for you. And that will sink into people's hearts. There's a big difference, you know. Someone comes to the Sunday feast. Today's a Sunday feast, right? So someone comes to the Sunday feast, and a devotee walks up to them and say, look, Srila Prabhupada is a pure devotee, and you should stay here and worship Krishna according to his instructions. Now, there's some good preaching right there. But wouldn't it be better to come up to such a person and say, I have accepted Srila Prabhupada personally as the greatest teacher in my life. I have learned so much from him. And I love what he has given to so many people. And therefore, I want to serve the society he began. So I hope you're comfortable here. Is there anything I can get for you or any questions that you may have? What a difference. See, no one can fight you on the way you feel and experience Srila Prabhupada. But if you insist that Prabhupada is a pure devotee, first of all, who are you to declare that? Are you the arbiter and definer of pure devotiness and have thus declared Prabhupada a pure devotee for that person? Wow, I'd like to meet you. It's the kind of thing that can be refuted. When we state facts, facts can be argued against. And that's okay. There's a place for that. But no one can argue against what you've experienced from Srila Prabhupada. And that is far more powerful. So we need to really offer from the heart what it is that we love so much about our Krishna conscious practice. And if you don't know what you love so much, you should really think about what it is that you do love. Because that's really the thing that you have that is most precious to offer to others. So here in Goswami's book, A Living Theology of Krishna Bhakti, Tamal Krishna Goswami was doing something that was very, very difficult. Here was his spiritual master, the person whom he gave everything for. And he worked very closely with Srila Prabhupada. Here he was to be now in the position of a scholar to, in some sense, analyze his spiritual master's teachings. A very different position from which he would normally work in relation to Srila Prabhupada. So this was a great challenge. In a way, it was a kind of risk. You don't quite know what's going to come out, and that's part of scholarly inquiry. You look into something deeply and thoroughly and analytically, and you're seeking, you know, truths about the subject matter. So there's a certain kind of risk involved in that. But what came out was something that even more deeply connected Goswami, I feel, to Srila Prabhupada and in his relationship with Srila Prabhupada. There were sides of Srila Prabhupada that he got to know that perhaps otherwise he would have remained unknown to him had he not conducted such a study. So this is the value of the sort of thing that I engage in, that Goswami is engaged in, and devotee scholars like myself who've gone through the, well, frankly, the hell of academic training. I think it's a test of endurance half the time. It's no easy thing to do. I mean, I remember changing from the University of Chicago to Harvard University, and the shift was a little difficult for me because I had taken Sanskrit at Chicago, and they did it differently there than at Harvard. And so when I came to Harvard, it was very, very difficult. And in fact, Harvard is known for its brutal way of teaching Sanskrit. No one teaches it anywhere else like that they do there. And I don't recommend it. It's horrible. It's downright abusive, intellectually abusive. But I remember that the final exam came up. And I had a young child, infant back then, and he had colic. This means that he cried all night because of stomach pains, right? And so the only way to appease him would be to pace back and forth and walk him, right? This is the night before my exam. So my wife and I would take turns every hour walking this little baby human. You know, they don't do much. Have you ever seen one of those? They don't do much. They either smile, look sort of with a blank expression, or cry and eat. It's pretty much their life, okay? So pacing back and forth the night before. What did I do in preparation for this exam? At Harvard, you can't use a dictionary or a grammar. You have to simply read the Sanskrit. And then you're graded or degraded. It's a horrible nightmare of an exam. No dictionary, no grammar, no nothing. You go in straight, right? And in preparation for this, I literally had 5,000 flashcards that I would go through for days. And I remember I had a whole room set up. The 5,000 flashcards started on the left. I pick up certain piles, and as I really felt I knew them, they'd go on the right side of the room. So I could see my progress, you know. So the left side of the room started high, the right side low, and it gradually, you know, shifted. But all that seemed to go out the window when I'm, like, you know, up all night walking this kid. So I go to the exam the next morning, and I'm in a total daze, kind of like I was yesterday in Bhagavatam class, right? So I come, and I'm a little early. I'm so afraid of getting stuck in traffic that I, you know, in Cambridge traffic, Cambridge traffic is a little tricky. So I'm sitting there, and I'm the only one there in the room because I'm early, and the proctor who's going to administer the exam, she's up there, and she said, "You're here for the Sanskrit exam, right?" I said, "Yes." Mm-hmm. And she said, "Sanskrit, that's a pretty tough language, isn't it?" I said, "Yes." And I just was thinking, you know, I need a boost here, you know. She said, "Well, the only Sanskrit I know is Hare Krishna." I immediately, I could feel my spine become erect, a kind of energy flow throughout my body, and my mind became sharp, and I aced the exam because of her. I looked all over campus for her after, you know, the week I found out, and tried to thank her, but, you know, it's a large institution. So, little ways Krishna popped in just in time, right? But going through the academic process is very, very difficult. Someone asked me the other day, "So how do you go through such rigorous training and keep up with your devotional life?" I say, "Well, your morning program is very boiled down to chanting. And, you know, I mean, you wouldn't believe how fast you can go through the Gurdavashtakam. I mean, it's just, it's a rigorous program. And it is a lot of austerity, a lot of tapas. But there are, you know, little blessings that you can find along the way. It was the Chaitanya Charitamrita on which I focused for my master's, my first master's thesis. By the way, my two other master's degrees are still for sale. I have not gotten any takers yet for that. But I'm just putting that out there. So that was the thesis that Srila Prabhupada saw. And that was on my way to Cambridge. And I wrote to Prabhupada on the insistence that of Satsarup Goswami. He insisted that I write to Prabhupada, and I kept telling him I don't want to, because Prabhupada is very ill right now, and I don't want to bother him. But he insisted that I do so, and eventually, frankly, I did so, because I got tired of getting these nasty letters from Satsarup. So I finally did, and Satsarup wrote me back saying that Prabhupada would have written, except that he was he was on his back. Fully. This was about 2 months before he left this world. And so Prabhupada appreciated this intellectual pursuit. He wanted our devotees, some of them, a few, it's not for everyone, not even for some of us, it's only for a few of us who are able and willing to go through this kind of process. But what Goswami has done here, he has brought Prabhupada into a dialogue with world thought. And that's the great thing. And with a press like Oxford University Press, New York, which is considered even better than the one even in Oxford, because the distribution is much wider, and of course, it's American. No, cancel that. Strike that, okay? Strike that pro-American sentiment. It sometimes slips out. In any case, Oxford University Press was exactly the press that Goswami wanted to have his book published with because of its recognition. And it's like the other good presses, like Columbia and Yale and Princeton and California. And so it is unquestionably a work that will command attention from the best scholars in the field. And it already has. So Goswami is really an example for all of us, not just for those in the academic setting and trying to explicate the treasures of Vaishnava theology and philosophy, but it's an example of someone who, first, as I was saying the other day, yesterday morning, that seva comes first. Ashram not only comes very much second in the Vaishnava context, but ashram must conduce to that seva. It must, in some sense, enhance that seva. And if your ashram is impeding seva, change it. I was right there when Rupanuga did not want to be a sannyasi anymore. He felt he would be much more comfortable. And then, of course, the Gajendra, right, Leela, can be invoked, being more properly situated to serve is more important than sustaining an ashram artificially. And even in the Bhagavad Gita, there is only one verse that is repeated fully twice, once in the third chapter and once in the 18th chapter. The verse that says, better to perform your own dharma, right, imperfectly than that of another's perfectly. And this is repeated twice. It's the only verse, literally, from top to bottom, that's repeated. A couple of other verses are repeated in part, but none like this. And here, dharma can be taken as a synonym for seva. So this is very important. We are not the International Society for Seva Maintenance. I'm sorry, for ashram maintenance. You know, we're here for seva. We're here for Krishna consciousness, and the reason we're conscious of Krishna is because we want to serve him. So, In talking about Goswami's contributions, we really need to focus also on his example, not just what he wrote. And the example can be inspiring, I think, for all of us, no matter what the seva. The ability to be able to go beyond what we have normally considered this sort of kshetra, the field, the kshetra in which we've moved. Stretch that kshetra. Move that field further. See, and that was Prabhupada's mood. We all felt it back in the day, right? We all felt Prabhupada stretching us, right? Just stretching us more and more and more. And it was, there may have been some strain, some exertion there, but I mean, it was extremely pleasurable to find out that you could be made to do things that you had no idea you could do. That was the amazing experience that we all felt back then. I'm sure many of us feel it now. But it means stretching that kshetra. But make sure that your ashram fits that and enhances it and conduces to that seva. There are many things that you will find interesting in Goswami's work. I begin the last chapter, and I'll just end with this and open up for any comments or questions. As I mentioned, it was a very odd seva for me to finish someone else's book. I can hardly finish my own. And to finish another person's book is even more difficult. In my concluding chapter, titled Prema, Purest Love, Prayojana, the sub-chapter heading The Uncontainable Nature of Prema. That Goswami's departure occurred at the point when he was just about to complete his dissertation, when also he was about to embark on a discussion of prema, the ultimate goal of Krishna bhakti, points to an important aspect of the subject of prema. A certain irony arises when Goswami, in the final phase of his life, missed writing about the final phase of bhakti. And again, it is telling that Goswami, during his last pilgrimage to holy places in India, was in the process of writing a chapter entitled Dying the Good Death, the Transfigurative Power of Bhakti. Moreover, confirming my own experience, close friends and colleagues with whom Goswami was in contact during his final weeks report that his comments just prior to leaving for Mayapur were unusual, uncharacteristic, as if he had been anticipating that this would be his last pilgrimage to India. He would be visiting not only the movement's world headquarters, but its most sacred location, the land Goswami himself had acquired for ISKCON several decades earlier, and where, as per his instructions in his last will and testament, his remains would be entombed. It is as if his Lord were drawing Goswami closer through the holiest place on earth that celebrates supreme love in the person of Chaitanya. The events and factors surrounding Goswami's death certainly call attention to a life immersed in bhakti. But what specifically stands out is how, for the bhakta, prema becomes transfigurative, to use Goswami's word, how bhakti transforms the life of the bhakta into something more beautiful, more elevated, which points to the uncontainable experience of a love so pure, so intense, and so intimately connected with the divine that it ultimately becomes impossible for the bhakta to remain in this world. Thus, death itself for the bhakta becomes a welcomed phase of life, a passageway through which the bhakta attains a divinely endowed eternal life. Of course, it would be absurd to make any judgment of Goswami with regard to his after-death destination or the level of his personal achievements for salvation, and that is hardly what is being said here. But put simply, the coincidence of Goswami's departure just before he was to write about love and death resonates with the idea that prema ultimately cannot be contained within the physical body. So for the bhakta, and again, Goswami's example, even in not finishing the book, sends a message to us that death is a passageway. Death is an opportunity to expand that prema that could not be contained, that prema that was had been building up throughout our whole life of bhakti, that just needs to expand. Very much in the way that we saw Mahaprabhu Gauranga's body just have a meltdown, right? In various leelas of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, his body would be disfigured, transfigured, if you will. So we have a lot to look forward to. I mean, I don't ever see anyone going around temples and coming up to me, Garuda, after reading what you said, I can't wait to die. Could you help me along? Could you be the Dr. Kevorkian of the movement? Kill me. It's not like that. I'm so excited about death. No, it's not like that. We're excited about pleasing Krishna and pleasing Vaishnavas and connecting so lovingly and sweetly with other Vaishnavas. That's what we're so excited about. And death comes along, it's hardly noticeable for a devotee, except that I've got more. I've got more access to prema now. That's the wonderful thing about bhakti. The offering of the heart is such that the heart becomes so full, it just spills over. It can't be contained. The love and the devotion and the connecting with so many hearts of anyone we meet. What to speak of a Vaishnava? It's a very special heart in a Vaishnava. We have to be careful in ISKCON that we don't become routinized and we don't become, you know, ritualized in the negative sense. We have to be careful not to take each other for granted. We have to watch carefully that we don't enter into patterns of depersonalization with one another. We have to be very careful. That can happen easily. Sometimes we lose sight of the goal, which is the hearts of others, where Krishna resides. It's just that simple. The reason we worship here is because we are practicing seeing Krishna in the heart, everywhere. Otherwise, bhakti is very limited. You can only have bhakti in the temple. This is just not the case. I had it right there in the exam room. Although the difference was she was worshiping on the altar of my heart. She woke my altar up. She woke, you know, the deities were asleep, and she, you know, it's a time for aarti. I'll end by a little anecdote. I had the pleasure of going to Gurukula in Alachua, Florida. Florida is a state in the U.S. By the way, in that state, the sun shines a lot there. I just want to tell you that. It's just meteorological information. It's not important. Okay. In any case, I had the pleasure of talking to about 13 9-year-olds to 11-year-olds. Yeah. And they were very sweet children, and they're you know, the mid-sized humans, about mid-sized. Not the small one that we talked about earlier, but the mid-sized. And they offered me a chair and all that. I said, no, let me just sit with all of you. I'm going to sit on the floor. And we had fun. I told them what I do, and you know, I showed them a few of the books that I've written, and talked a little bit about Srila Prabhupada, and I said, so they had the little miniature Radha Krishna deities on a kind of sort of simple altar behind us, and I said, so why do we worship Krishna? I asked the children that. And so one of them said, so we can get out of this world. I said, okay. That could be a purpose. Mm-hmm. I said, but what might be another reason? We worship Krishna to please Krishna. I said, okay, good. So another child said, we worship Krishna to get to Vaikuntha. I said, okay. So what happens? What happens? You worship Krishna all your lives, and you get to Krishna Loka, Vrajadhama, and you knock on Krishna's door, and Krishna opens, and you say, I'm here to serve you and love you. And Krishna sort of looks at you, and what does he do? He sort of looks at you and says, look, I wasn't expecting you, and I am too busy right now with the cows, and a few of my boyfriends were. So can you come back later? Is that what happens? And they all said, no, that doesn't happen. Well, then what happens? And why would he answer the door any differently? Why do we worship? Why do we serve Krishna? I kept trying to pull it out of them. And it was instructive to me, because I don't think we talk about this too much. We worship Krishna because Krishna longs for us. He loves us. Once I said this to a colleague in the academics, he said, oh, well, that's no big deal. Jesus loves us too. I said, yes, but there's a threat with that one. Someone once came up to me and said, do you love Jesus? I said, yes. How can you not love Jesus? Well, that's good, because if you didn't, you know, do you know what kind of suffering you might, you know? I said, whoa. And she asked me, did I know what suffering was like? And I said, not really. I mean, I'm kind of spoiled. And very lucky and very blessed. And not, no, I don't know what suffering is. I know of suffering. And in comparison, no. No. And I said to her, I said, are you implying to me that if I don't worship your Lord, that I'm going to suffer in hell for all eternity? And she started talking. I said, hey, wait a second. I'm going to tell you right now, I would rather suffer in that hell than to love a Lord that was so weak that he had to threaten me to love him. Because that is not love at all. You cannot coerce love. You cannot force love. Love, by its very nature, must have the background of freedom. You know, I was walking along campus once. And, you know, in between classes, the sidewalks are crowded, right? So there were two young ladies in front of me, obviously going to class. And one turned to the other and said, does Mike still love you? And the other lady said, he better or I'll kill him. Do you have any idea how this affected me? Someone's life was just threatened. Right in front of me. I have been looking for Mike for years now. My theory is that he is dead. And he might be better off than being in a relationship where he was threatened to love her. Kr- Krishna is not a judging God. He is not a condemning God. He is not a coercive God. He waits an eternity for us to turn to Him and to love Him. Govinda and I were talking at breakfast the other day. Krishna's playing the flute. Do you see Gokulananda playing the flute? He has no business playing the flute when he's right next to Radha. And the Gita Govinda, as soon as the gopis arrive, or Radha arrives, there's no need for a flute. So why is he playing the flute? Well, as it turns out, that love call is now directed toward us with Radha. So he now picks up his flute to call all of us. You said that the other day, Govinda. You said, he's calling us. That's what you said to me. Very, very right on. He is calling us. They are calling us. And it's very common for all of us to say, well, we worship Krishna. But I say, no, we don't worship Krishna. We worship Radha Krishna. We worship a divine relation, as we were speaking. We worship a divine relation. And the Johannine saying in the Bible is, God is love. But we say love is God. There's a difference. Okay? Subject and predicate. Love is God. And we are the ones who are blessed to have that gift and to offer that gift to the world. So this book is one way that this is offered. And I talk about all of this in the concluding chapter. I've said way too much here. Let me just open for two. I don't know exactly the schedule. Do we have time for comments or questions?